Okay, let's get started talking about hematology. This comes from chapter 34, pages 731 through 741. So the first thing we're going to talk about is hemostasis. So this is our body's natural reaction to an injury. So this is how our body tries to protect itself. Its goals are to stop the bleeding and then repair any damage by conserving blood and preventing infection. That occurs by kind of this cascade of events. So the injury occurs, the vessel vasoconstricts, and then we have primary hemostasis and secondary hemostasis. So the primary is going to be platelet clotting. And secondary is going to be the coagulation cascade. And hemostasis consists of the vascular endothelium, platelets, and our coagulation factors. So thrombocytopenia, this is when platelets are less than 50,000. So obviously that results in abnormal hemostasis. This can occur from impaired production, increased destruction, or abnormal distribution. It causes prolonged bleeding from minor trauma or spontaneous bleeding without any kind of injury. The three types that we're discussing are ITP, TTP, and then HIT. So, immune thrombocytopenia, this is ITP. It is the most common. Platelet survival is shortened because they're coated in antibodies. And once they get to the spleen, they're misidentified due to that antibody coating, and the spleen destroys them. This is an acute condition in children and a chronic condition in adults. Some risk factors are autoimmune disease, like H. pylori, SLE. Different infections can cause this. Females tend to have this more than males, and then recent viral illness in children. So then TTP, the thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, this is uncommon. It's characterized by microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, thrombocytopenia, neurologic changes, and fever in the absence of infection, as well as renal problems. So it's caused by a deficiency of a plasma enzyme. It's the ADAMTS13 that breaks down the von Willebrand clotting factor into a normal size. Without that enzyme, unusually large amounts of VWF attach to activated platelets, and so that promotes platelet aggregation. When the clotting factor is broken down, it causes inappropriate clotting, leads to kidney failure, myocardial infarction, and stroke. It is a medical emergency because if it's left untreated, it can cause bleeding and clotting at the same time. And this primarily happens in previously healthy adults. Certain drug toxicities can cause this. Pregnancy or preeclampsia, infection, as well as autoimmune disease. And we have our heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. So this usually occurs 5 to 14 days after onset of heparin therapy. We know that this is occurring because a platelet count decreases by more than 50% or it's less than 150,000. So heparin causes two major responses: platelet destruction and vascular endothelial injury. Bleeding symptoms in these patients are usually unusual because the platelets rarely fall below 20,000. But DVTs and PEs are the most common complication of HIT. You have to be careful because skin necrosis, stroke, and in organ damage, specifically the kidneys, can occur. So, some clinical manifestations. Many are asymptomatic. So bleeding can be insidious or acute, internal or external. You got to monitor for mucosal or cutaneous bleeding. Mucosal may manifest as nosebleeds, or gingival bleeding. And this is something that a lot of people don't realize or just take into account of how vascular the nasal and oral cavities are. Prolonged bleeding usually doesn't occur until platelets are less than 50,000, and when they get to less than 20,000, that's when that life-threatening spontaneous bleeding happens. These people might have petechiae. Those are those small little flat reddish micro hemorrhages just under the skin. And when you get many petechiae in one area, it's called purpura. They might have pain or tenderness. You have to watch for signs of internal bleeding. So that could be weakness, syncope, dizziness, tachycardia, abdominal pain or distension, and hypotension. And they're going to have prolonged bleeding after any kind of venipuncture. So this is just a picture to show y'all the difference between the petechiae and the purpura. So interprofessional care, this is for the ITP. These people are going to be multiple, they're going to need multiple therapies, but they might not be treated until their platelets are less than 30,000. So corticosteroids, we use those to suppress the phagocytic response of splenic macrophages. So this alters the spleen's recognition, therefore increasing the platelet's lifespan. So the N-plate and Promacta, they are thrombopoietin receptor agonist, so that's going to increase the platelet production. Rituxan reduces the immune recognition of platelets, kind of like corticosteroids, so it increases the lifespan of the platelets. IVIG is given if they're not responsive to any other treatments. So IVIG, these compete with antiplatelet antibodies for the macrophage receptors in the spleens. Platelets should not be given prophylactically due to the risk of antibody formation, but we would give it if platelets, like the if the count is less than 10,000, if they have a case of life-threatening bleeding or they're bleeding before a procedure. And then a splenectomy, we would do that if they're not responsive to any other kind of treatment. So TTP, this type is all about treating the underlying disorder. So if the underlying disorder or the causative agent goes untreated, it's going to usually result in irreversible renal failure and death. Plasma exchange and corticosteroids go together. The plasma exchange can reverse the platelet consumption by supplying the right VWF and enzyme and removing the larger VWF molecules that binds with platelets. Cabilly reduces platelet aggregation and thrombosis. So that's going to reduce the kind of platelets getting eaten up with the microclots, and it'll normalize your platelet count. And then platelet administration is contraindicated because it's going to cause new VWF platelet complexes, increasing the clotting. So in HIT, we're going to stop all forms of heparin. That includes the flushes for vascular catheters. We use those a lot in hemodialysis catheters. So those would not continue. And we might switch them from heparin to argatroban. It's a direct thrombin inhibitor. They may need plasmapheresis or plasma exchange, as we previously talked about. And if they have a history of HIT, they will never or should never receive any kind of heparin or low molecular weight heparin. We also don't give them platelet transfusions because we don't want to enhance the thromboembolic events. So, what are we going to do for these people? We're going to discourage the use of over-the-counter meds that can add to cases of thrombocytopenia, so that's like aspirin. We're going to teach them to seek care. In the acute care, we want to prevent or control the bleeding. So it's usually going to be from superficial sites. The nasopharynx bleeding might be hard to detect if you do have to give them a shot. It would be a sub-Q. You're going to use a small needle and make sure that you hold pressure and avoid all IM injections. And know that women might have more than a usual amount of bleeding during their cycle. We also want to prevent constipation. We don't want them bearing down. Use an electric razor, no tweezing, no tattoos or piercing, and use a soft bristle toothbrush. So this is just a little picture to help remember bleeding precautions that we want to teach our patients. And then here is another little picture that kind of summarizes the treatment of the different types of thrombocytopenia. So now we're going to talk about DIC, disseminated intravascular coagulation. It is a very serious disorder characterized by bleeding and clotting, which ultimately leads to uncontrollable bleeding. It's caused by an underlying disease or condition. DIC is not like a condition of itself. It has to have a causative factor, so we have to find the cause to fix DIC. So this is kind of how it happens. So you have a precipitating factor. It could be sepsis, shock, an allergic reaction, cancer, cardiopulmonary arrest, and then it forms microclots throughout the body. And when all those microclots form, it uses all the clotting factors. So then our platelet numbers decrease rapidly and we start bleeding because all of our clotting factors were used to make those microclots. Your signs and symptoms are going to depend on whether it is bleeding or clotting. So some signs and symptoms of bleeding, this is going to be our oozing from IV sites, our petechiae. They might be pale, might be tachypneic, they might be, and they're going to be tachycardic, hypotensive, have abdominal distension, abdominal pain, bloody stool. They might have mental status changes, headache, vision changes, bone and joint pain. And for signs and symptoms of having clots, this is going to be our cyanosis, our mottling. They might have pulmonary emboli. They're going to be short of breath. You're going to see EKG changes, and then oliguria leading to kidney failure. So our diagnostic studies, to make this a little bit easier, basically tests that measure coagulation. So that's like our platelets, our fibrinogen. Those are going to be reduced. And then the values that measure clotting times are going to be prolonged. So, interprofessional care. One of the things that we're going to do is recognize those at risk. Table 3419. List out all the risk factors for DIC. Like I said, we're going to have to treat the underlying condition, administer any as-needed blood products. And DIC, if the benefits outweigh the risk, they might need heparin to help with those clots. We're going to monitor our intake and output. And safety is a huge thing with these people. So that's going to be safety from bleeding precautions, risk for falls, if they become dizzy. You know, we don't want them to get up and be running around because we don't want, if they fall and end up with a head bleed, that would not be good. So, blood administration and transfusion reactions. This comes from pages 758 to 761. So, whenever a provider orders blood on a patient, you want to make sure that they have consent. This blood needs to be given through a 20 gauge IV or larger. And we use special blood tubing. It's got a filter in it, and you prime it with normal saline. You never do any other kind of fluid besides normal saline. You have to have a second identifier. So grab a friend, another nurse, to identify the blood with you, and you're going to administer it as soon as it's ready. Transfusions have to be completed within 4 hours of picking it up, so you want to give it as quickly as you can, as long as it's safe. You have to look into the patient's history, like do they have cardiac issues or respiratory issues where giving them fluid too fast could be detrimental. So all of those are taken into account when you determine how fast to give blood, but it does have to be administered within 4 hours. So you're going to get vital signs before the transfusion, at the 15-minute mark, the 30-minute mark, hourly, and then after. And then you've got to stay with the patient during the first 15 minutes because that is when a reaction would occur, if one is going to occur. So talking about blood transfusion reactions, so they can be mild to life-threatening. If it occurs, you need to stop the transfusion. You're going to maintain the IV with normal saline. You need to call blood bank and the provider immediately. You're going to monitor your vital signs, recheck the identifying tags and numbers on the blood that you transfused, and do not throw it away. Blood bank is going to want to look into all of that, and you're going to follow your specific facility policy. So, acute hemolytic reaction. So, this is what happens when incompatible blood products are infused. Basically, the patient's antibodies attach to the antigens and destroy them. So, they might have fever with or without chills. They're going to have pain in their back, their stomach, their chest, infusion site pain. They're going to be tachycardic, tachypneic, hypotensive. They're going to have an impending sense of doom. And then a severe hemolytic reaction could be AKI, shock, cardiac arrest, DIC. We're going to treat all of those things if they occur. You might have to give diuretics as ordered to maintain urine output and insert a Foley catheter for hourly urine output. So, circulatory overload. This is kind of what we talked about previously when we were discussing of how fast to give a blood product. So this is what happens when fluid or blood is given faster than the circulation can keep up with. They're going to have signs and symptoms of fluid overload. So shortness of breath, pulmonary congestion, tachycardia, hypertension. They might have a cough. JVD. We're going to place these clients in an upright position with their feet dependent, get a chest x-ray, and give oxygen and diuretics. So, transfusion-related acute lung injury, so trolley reaction. This is a reaction between the anti-leukocyte antibodies and the recipient's leukocytes, and it causes pulmonary inflammation and a capillary leak. This is the leading cause of transfusion-related deaths. They're going to have fever, chills, hypotension, frothy sputum, dyspnea, and this arises within 1 to 6 hours of transfusion. These people are going to need oxygen, corticosteroids, a chest x-ray. So the non-hemolytic febrile reaction, this is a sensitization to donor white blood cells, platelets, or plasma proteins. These people will get sudden chills, rigors, fever, headache, vomiting. We're going to give them the impending sense of doom, anxiety, shortness of breath, wheezing that will progress to cyanosis, bronchospasm, hypotension, and possibly cardiac arrest. So for these people, we want to start CPR if indicated, administer oxygen, have epinephrine ready. They might need antihistamines and corticosteroids. The last thing I wanted to show y'all, so on page, let's see, 760, there is a table 34.35, and it's acute transfusion reaction. So that is a good place to get a whole lot of information about transfusion reactions.